try to do is present something in three parts, not because that has any special significance at a place like this, but it's simply easier to organize. Very brief summary of the rise and historically of the rise of the what I call the New Christian Right, or the NCR, that we'll be talking about. Then its place in the election of 1980, and then, as Larry promised you in the commercial that he did this morning at breakfast, an update of what's happened since the book came out, because the book had to be ready about for the printer about January, as I remember it, and it came out in April. And when you're dealing with something like this, you're dealing really with journalism, not with history. And so there are things that are happening, and even since I prepared for here, other things have come out. If you're interested, and if you have the if you have access to it, I think our library here has it. The May 18th issue of New Yorker magazine has a long and very good profile of Jerry Falwell. And somebody, that's obviously, it's going to be a full book. Francis, it's a Scots name. Francis, not Langford. Something other. Anyway, it's in the May 18th issue of New Yorker. And if you can't get it here, you can get it at home. And I should also say that the essence of what I'm going to be talking about today is in an article which I'm sure is not a bestseller, but has certain advantages. It's called Theology Today. It's a theological quarterly put out by Princeton Seminary, and it'll be in the July issue of Theology Today. It has a staggering total in a country of 222 million people. It has a staggering total of 6,000 circulation, and most of those are libraries who take it. So, and that was funny with that one. The first time they accepted the article, they said, "We'll pay you an honorarium of $50." And you don't write an article for money if you're only going to get $50. And then the second time, when I sent in the revisions, they said, "We'll pay you an honorarium of $35." And so I said, "Well, pretty soon, if I keep writing you, I'm going to be paying you money, it's going to shrink." And so they were slightly embarrassed. But and Princeton is Presbyterian, and Princeton is also Scots, so they're very thrifty with their money. All right, anyway, a little introduction, and then a little bit of the history, which is a summary of the book, and then something of the 1980 election, and of the and then an update. And then I'll take a stand on the New Christian Right myself, and what I think as a historian who deals with the past, and I'll project into the future. One of the fun things about Holden is you can get out of your role, of your professional role of what you do at home, and try to do some different things. Okay, and if this sounds a little bit too pat and formal, I apologize for that, because this was for reading, not for delivering. But I don't know how else I could do this in a short period of time. The sudden, well-financed, and the slickly promoted burst into national politics of the New Christian Right, or the NCR, came as a surprise to the American religious scene during the 1980 campaign. The Religion News Writers Association voted it the most significant news story of 1980. Most observers had been convinced that the energies of religious conservatives were bound up exclusively in the born-again revival. Remember Colson and Cleaver and Jimmy Carter and everything else. I call it the Colson-Cleaver-Carter syndrome that we had in Anita Bryant and the whole thing in 76, 77. Now, and this is important, without precedent, evangelicals and fundamentalists stepped into the political arena with a remarkable political clout and technological sophistication. Their apparent victories with lawmakers targeted for defeat gave the NCR program both credibility and momentum for the future. In short, the NCR added a powerful, unpredictable ingredient to America's unique blend of religion and politics. Beneath all the campaigning hullabaloo of moral judgments based on voting records, mass fundraising campaigns, and television promotion, the NCR, and this is my thesis, brought a new and important conviction to the political arena. This was the belief that the national government, led by religious males, was the sole remaining human agency to keep America in line with the moral ideal conservatives envisaged for it. I'll repeat that. The belief that the national government was the sole remaining human agency to keep America in line with the moral ideal conservatives envisioned for it. Calling for less government in people's lives, get the government off your back, was one of the chief issues, you remember, in 80. Calling for less government in people's lives, the NCR wanted at the same time national political power to carry the program shaped for the 1980 campaign, and what I suggest as a contradiction in the NCR rhetoric, calling for less government interference in life. They thought the only way in which the moral restoration in America could be carried out was giving more power to people in Washington with the various issues which we'll be talking about. Leaders contended that this was a Christian-inspired moral program because it rested on a source of authority that religious moderates, mainliners, and ecumenicals did not have, namely the inerrant Word of God. The Bible, Falwell writes, is absolutely infallible, without errors in all matters pertaining to faith and practice, as well as in such areas as geography, science, history, etc. So therefore, if you have an inerrant, infallible answer book, you don't have to worry about debating issues because you simply go to the answer book and there it is. And the trouble with America, you see, so far is that it has simply gone to the wrong answer book, and it's time to get back to the inerrant, infallible, verbally inspired Bible as the correct answer book. All right, empowering NCR leaders such biblical authority gave them confidence to determine precisely what they deemed right and wrong, moral and immoral, and private or public life. They claimed the nation reached this is just what I said. They claimed the nation reached its present state of moral decay because Americans failed to believe that ethical answers were possible. They claimed liberals and secular humanists had duped the people into thinking moral absolutes simply did not exist. But to the NCR, the absolutes were realities. This nation's condition was so desperate that only leaders who understood that the moral crisis could be allowed to govern. Hence, the power of the national government was the one viable force to be harnessed to pull the force of moral transformation. And this is now to get into so much for the prologue or the overture, and the curtain goes up now. Okay. Part one. The historical background. The concept of an American presidential candidate leading the populace to godly righteousness originated really with William Jennings Bryan in 1896. More recently, Senator Barry Goldwater's candidacy, 1964, supported by like-minded lawmakers, proposed using the power of the federal government to protect the values of his supporters. Conservatives learned after his landslide defeat that they could not simply rely on an attractive candidate with a revival and righteous platform. They would need greater political know-how and resources than they had mustered. The 1960s furnished neither strong leadership nor sufficient funds for such a crusade. But and this, the key point really comes here in 1968. But in 1968, a fundraiser for George Wallace, who was running on the American Party ticket, working for George Wallace, showed what might be done by using computer technology to catalog names and special interests of like-minded voters. Richard Viguerie, before you had read my book or anything, who had heard the name Richard Viguerie beforehand? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 10% of the group here, okay. Because he is just as important as Jerry Falwell in the whole story. And I imagine everybody here has heard of Jerry Falwell, picture on Newsweek and everything else, but Viguerie is just as important. Okay. Richard Viguerie had collected the names of thousands of persons expressing support for one or a few issues: gun control, religious exercises in the public school, the women's movement, and others. These names became the basis for the enormously successful direct mail campaigns of 1980. Although evangelicals and fundamentalists perceived the country was falling deeply into moral stagnation during the early 1970s, they did not produce an alternative candidate. These are the conservatives. They did not produce an alternative candidate to head off Senator George McGovern or incumbent President Richard Nixon. Their vote was as an organized bloc really was negligible in 1972, 1976 too for that matter. But around the edges of power in Washington, two additional leaders emerged alongside Viguerie to help propel the disenchanted voters, those who had voted, for instance, for Wallace in 1968. Two other people emerged alongside Viguerie to help propel the disenchanted voters into power. First, another key figure here, Paul Weyrich, with Adolph Coors' financial assistant, and that is the Coors of the Great Northwest. Paul Weyrich, with Adolph Coors' financial assistance, created the Committee for the Survival of a Free Congress in an attempt to define the issues and produce conservative answers. Howard Phillips, another of the leading figures here, then established the Conservative Caucus, a private organization to research earlier electioneering techniques and to lay plans for conservative campaigning. At Senator Jesse Helms' suggestion, Viguerie, Weyrich, and Phillips helped form the umbrella National Conservative Political Action Committee, led now by Terry Dolan. a many-faceted agency to initiate a conservative takeover from the grassroots. Their appeal rested on calling America back to moral and political conservatism. Needing experience and a national leader, because none of these people were polished platform performers and didn't want to go out in front of the audience and do the necessary oratory and the PR and press the flesh sort of thing. Needing experience and a national leader, the conservative coalition collected more names and funds and built bridges to the smaller one-issue action groups, especially the pro-life forces. This was very important, that they were able to work together. Conservatives for a long time spent more time arguing among themselves than they did with anybody else. And one of the secrets of 1980s campaign is that they were able to unite and unite while the opposite forces, and the opposite forces are still, you know, are still very much factionalized and everything else, and it's Teddy versus Mondale right now, and so on, and that doesn't sound look like it's going to, you know, get any better. The central theme remained focused on using the national government's power to preserve specified standards of morality. That's so important. The national government decides what's moral and what isn't moral. That's crucial to everything I'm saying here. As signs of moral decline continued to mount in the late 1970s, the conservative coalition's appeal to the general public continued to intensify. The incipient NCR turned attention to, quote, family issues. NCR leaders alleged that the American family was decaying due to abortion, due to the women's movement, gay rights, the lack of religious exercises in the public schools. These became the rock-bed issues for which the NCR would fight to protect righteousness in the American family and society. An allied direct mail organization named Christian Voice, out of Pasadena, was to carry out the moral majority's message to the public. Directed by righteous men, the federal government, according to these programs, would stop abortions, would block civil rights for gays. It would install religious exercises in public schools, continue to block the ERA, and give the Pentagon what it wanted in armaments. Moral majority leaders organized communications through local newspaper ads, mass rallies, congregational meetings, television spots, saturation direct mailings, and door-to-door solicitation. Yet these direct mailers, Viguerie, Wyrick, Phillips, and so many others, Ed McAteer and so many others, the direct mailers were scarcely known outside their immediate settings. They needed much wider exposure and daily contact with the people who were targeted for solicitation in the 1980 campaign. After careful negotiations in early 1979, Viguerie, Wyrick, Phillips, along with allies such as Robert Billings and Ed McAteer, found the celebrity leaders they needed. These were the television or, quote, electronic preachers, now bringing in $1 million a week each of their own revenue for their programs. Falwell of the Old Time Gospel Hour, Pat Robertson of Christian Broadcasting Network, or sometimes called the 700 Club, James Robeson of the Robeson Evangelism Association. Is Robeson, does he have an outlet in Seattle or Portland, James Robeson, on Sunday mornings? I'm just curious. He doesn't have one in Minneapolis, but he's known. You haven't heard of James Robeson. Okay. Anybody sees James Robeson on a steady, on a regular basis? Robeson? Okay. I'm just wondering where. I think his strength is mostly in the southeast and southwest and the east coast. Okay. And then the other one, of course, Jim Baker of PTL. So you've got four electronic preachers here. Falwell and Robeson, who usually, well, not usually, but always have Sunday morning services. And then Robertson and Baker, who have Monday through Friday, 1 to 1.5 hour programs as the four leading electronic preachers. By this time, the old AVA, or the advance guard of the electronic preachers, Humbard, Graham, and Roberts, had pretty much stepped out of direct public action, even though all of them are still active, obviously, in religious televising. They weren't involved in this particular new group. Okay. The direct mailers continued through mid-1979 while negotiating an alliance among the preachers. Baker stayed on, this is why among these four, they reached the decision to follow was the man they wanted. The direct mailers needed, as I said, a front man, somebody to go out and do the PR, the speaking, and all the rest. Jim Baker stayed clear, concentrating on what was very successful programming for him. When you stop to think of it, in 1976, he was drawing $50,000 a week. In 1980, he was drawing $1 million a week. Nothing succeeds like success with this. He was concentrating on his successful programming, healing, praise, and entertainment. Pat Robertson expressed strong support for the causes of moralism, although he disagreed with the judgments made by the authors of the moral report cards, who surveyed the voting records of U.S. senators. Very difficult, for instance, to draw the implications that the moral report cards were sound when the leading evangelical senator in Washington, namely Mark Hatfield, draws a 23. And then people who were convicted on Abscam get 100. There's something there that I don't understand. Okay. But Falwell and Robeson, both solidly fundamentalistic in theology and politics, came to an understanding with the direct mailer leaders. Here's where the alliance really was reached, and I call it, these are the two, in the book I call this the two parents of the new Christian right. The direct mailers on the one hand, who knew how to get the vote, who now knew how to get the money, but didn't want to do the PR work, and the electronic preachers on the other hand, who were skilled orators, who knew how to get the crowds, knew how to bring in attention, and knew how to dramatize the issues. Falwell takes his Liberty Baptist College students out on the road with his I Love America show, and you know, brings in the crowds and brings in the bucks. Okay, together they created the Moral Majority, a political action program to issue report cards on national lawmakers' voting records, to raise funds to defeat liberal Democratic senators and congressmen, to register citizens to vote, and to vote conservative. An alliance was struck between the Moral Majority, the direct mailers, and select national celebrity television preachers, creating really a new phenomenon in American political and religious life. For all its smooth organization, the NCR campaign ran into serious crises almost right away. The most important occurred in August 1980, when Governor Ronald Reagan endorsed the NCR program at a workshop in Dallas. At the same time at this program that Reagan said, "You can't endorse me, but I endorse you." That came off, remember, very clearly. At the same time, the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, the largest Protestant denomination in America, the Reverend Bailey Smith, stated that God did not hear the prayers of a Jew. This statement brought on a major uproar of protest from Protestant, Roman Catholic, and Jewish leaders. In turn, Falwell and Robeson, now these were the two frontmen, really, for what I call the Christian right, Falwell and Robeson paraphrased Bailey's fundamentalistic tenet. Their reformulation was unacceptable to the American Jewish community. Finally, when the Moral Majority came under sustained national criticism and receipts fell off, Falwell commented that God does hear the prayer of any sincere seeker. Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum, director of the American Jewish Committee's Interreligious Affairs program, summed up the situation. He observed how, quote, wild a religio-political movement can become if it goes uncontested. They're running into a massive reaction they didn't know existed. During the campaigns, reporters learned Falwell had invented a conversation that he claimed to have had with President Jimmy Carter. Falwell initially told an audience in Alaska that he had asked Carter why he, that is Carter, had known practicing homosexuals on his senior staff at the White House. Falwell said that the president replied, quote, "I am president of the American people, and I believe I should represent everyone," close quote. When a tape recording of the Carter-Falwell conversation was played back, it became Falwell had never asked that question. Falwell later admitted he had fabricated the conversation. Fabrication is a polite word for another verb. All right. As the election campaign continued, the rhetoric from the NCR heated up. The NCR called, for instance, George McGovern a baby killer for his position on abortion, and suggested Frank Church supported removal of the anti-Soviet guided missiles from the American defense armory. Then some Americans organized to fight back. Ranking leaders from the Southern Baptist and United Methodist churches, from the National Council of Churches, and two nationally based organizations, one called Moral Alternatives in Politics, and the other Norman Lear's People for the American Way, started small but energetic counterattacks on television and in printed pamphlets. The American Civil Liberties Union later joined in the rebuttal, claiming in a letter written by Senator McGovern that the new right, quote, is seeking, seeking to destroy our basic rights and individual liberties. As the nation continued to argue whether a lawmaker could be judged moral on the basis of selected votes, Election Day arrived with its silencing effect. The Reagan-Bush ticket took 51% of the national popular vote, with support from all sections of the country. Equally important for the NCR was the defeat of five of the six senators on its target list: George McGovern, Frank Church, Birch Bayh, Gaylord Nelson, and John Culver. Of the six, only Alan targeted, or on the hit list, only Alan Cranston of California was reelected. Falwell and the Christian Voice and other new right organizations claimed their support turned out of office the lawmakers whom they had judged immoral. A couple of them, the cork got out of their libido bottle. You remember Howard Phillips said, now that the new right is in office, we should take away the right to vote from women. We should also take away their right to hold property. You know, go back like about the 1830s.
Who said that?
Howard Phillips, president of the Conservative Caucus. And I've got that in print and documented and so on. As I say, the cork got out of his libido bottle at that particular point. What I call the politics of resentment, just waiting, you know, for their chance with us. Okay, Act Two. Since the election, the new Christian right continued to generate a variety of public reactions. Both the Religion News Writers Association and editors of Christian Century recognized its rapid rise to power as, quote, the most significant religion news story of 1980. Yet, and this is important, yet surprisingly, that prominence did not produce widespread public recognition. This is something that's really amazing. Did not produce widespread public recognition. A mid-December 1980 Gallup poll showed that the NCR's most publicized group, namely Moral Majority, was known to only 40% of the total public. And of that, and of the total American public, only 26%, I mean, only 40% had even heard of the Moral Majority, of the total American public. Only 26% were familiar with the Moral Majority's objectives of the total American public. Of that number, again boiling it down to now 26%, 13% were critical, 8% were favorable, and 5% were undecided. So of the total American population, 8% were favorable towards the Moral Majority. With this, now, this apparent paradox of simultaneous power and obscurity can be understood by looking at two other questions. One, whether the presence of the NCR made an important difference in the Senate races, and two, whether its demands for restoring morality in American life were in fact creating a backlash strong enough to weaken its existing strength. The balance of this talk will try to answer those questions. Today, debate continues over the extent to which campaigning by the NCR altered the 1980 election results, especially among the six targeted senators. Did it really make a difference with these five who were defeated or Cranston who won? So supporters and critics alike agreed on this much, and this is very important. The NCR had not been repudiated at the polls. None of its endorsements carried with them, except for Cranston, the kiss of defeat. The television preachers and direct mailers had outplanned, outworked, outspent, and outmaneuvered the opposition in almost every case. They had outplanned, outworked, outspent, and outmaneuvered the opposition. It became obvious that in this age of rapid social and technological change, the political appeals to traditional and dogmatic morality had not lost their attractiveness. If we're in an age of change, you'd think that people would want to sort of go with the flow and change, but the appeals to traditional dogmatic morality still had tremendous appeal for the American voters. The NCR unquestionably mobilized citizens, many of whom were long dormant in elective politics, and turned these into a powerful, supportive voter bloc. No one from Capitol Hill lawmakers down to the smallest donors could ignore the implications of that achievement with us. This is an organized, active, well-funded organization. Nevertheless, the NCR did not prove its presence had been the decisive factor in the campaigns. A leading Reagan strategist named Edward Mahay, not Ed Meese, but Edward Mahay, concluded the NCR support, quote, probably provided the margin of victory for Republican senators in Oklahoma, Alabama, and perhaps Idaho, and that would have been Frank Church. Only the last state had been on the hit list. Washington, D.C., political columnist Robert Kaiser detected other circumstances leading to the defeats of these targeted senators. The well-known liberals, McGovern, By, Church, and Culver, were from essentially conservative states. In each case, the other senator was a Republican, which gives you some indication of the political climate in those four political states. I know Proxmire is a Democrat, and he's not in this list. So you have two Democrats from Wisconsin, and I'm not mentioning Wisconsin. But McGovern, By, Church, and Culver were from essentially conservative states. Kaiser suggested McGovern and Church had been, quote, out of step for years with their conservative Western constituencies on many issues, and I think this is true. Just the way, and I would think many of you from Washington would agree that Magnuson was pretty much, you know, out of touch, and he was what, 75, which is fine for many things to do in life, but he didn't have the old vim and vigor. Okay, By's three previous victories had been extremely close in a Republican state. Moreover, the liberals were clearly identified with the woes of the Carter administration and had become victims of association for voters who wanted new faces and fresh policies. And this is a curious anomaly. On the other hand, in some states where the NCR campaigned, voters re-elected moderate to liberal incumbents. This is a strange kind of thing. It wasn't as though the NCR carried every place. In some places, well-known liberals were re-elected. Gary Hart of Colorado, the best known of these. He had been McGovern's campaign manager, you remember, in 1972, and is one of the favorites in the important liberals in Congress. He didn't have very much trouble, really, in Colorado. Patrick Leahy of Vermont would be another one. Thomas Eagleton, you remember Eagleton, 72, unfortunately, some people remember, of Missouri, and then Robert Packwood, of course, even though he's a Republican, he's still a liberal of Oregon. So, any final conclusion on the difference which the NCR made, I think, must wait the analysis of the sophisticated voter profile studies, which we have. And we have some of these, and I'm sure there are political science graduate students who are doing these things for their dissertations right now. They developed some very sophisticated techniques, checking out on how precincts have voted over the years and what the variables have been. And they found out, for instance, to give you an analysis, they found out that in some places that there were people who voted for Kennedy or against Kennedy only because he was a Catholic. So they can prove this without Leon Epstein of Wisconsin developed these voter profile analysis techniques. And they proved that beyond any doubt that in certain things, certain cases, that people did vote on one issue. And Kennedy's Catholicism helped him directly in some places and hindered him directly in others. And we have to, in a sense, wait to 1984 to see how these precincts voted in 84 to see whether or not there was a change from the 1981 with this. The jury is still out, really, on this, with us. Until then, and this is my opinion, it is reasonable to surmise that the NCR established a firm beachhead that did not seriously affect the outcome of the 1980 election. Further, whether the NCR can utilize majority power and its attendance responsibilities in the next few years remains somewhat doubtful. Moral majority programs implemented since the election could very well produce a strong backlash from mainline churches, from evangelical circles, and the general public. And this, I think, would weaken its present strength. You see, true to a fundamentalist mindset, the NCR chose to pursue its programs apart from all mainline and most evangelical church groups. To be loyal to its own convictions, the NCR criticized consistently the mainstream church, or churches, disregarding the loss of potential allies. Consequently, the abrasive moral majority pronouncements and programs produced vigorous criticism from prominent church leaders. Among evangelicals, for instance, Billy Graham and the editors of Christianity Today were usually the most outspoken dissenters from the Christian right. Graham said the moral majority was, quote, not my cup of tea. He told Falwell to, quote, address matters such as social injustice and the arms race. Graham deplored among television preachers, quote, the lack of concern for the hungry masses in inner city ghettos. And he called on all conservatives to return to the priority of the gospel. Christianity Today, which is the leading evangelical journal in the country, found the NCR theocratic, overly prone to concentrate on single issues, and likely to become a pawn for a political party. In the evangelical newsletter, which is a spin-off from, some of you know, Eternity magazine coming out of Philadelphia, the evangelical newsletter found the NCR guilty of superficial analysis of choosing safe issues, quote, which do not touch the pocketbooks of the rich. I mean, it's great to run on a political campaign and make all kinds of promises and tell people we're going to save the country and it isn't going to cost you any money with this. It accused the NCR of insensitivity to the poor and needy and guilty of identifying itself too closely with American nationalism. Slow to understand the tenacious mass appeal of the NCR, however, mainliners finally began to work out a systematic counterattack. They argued the impossibility of measuring morality by voter report cards, pointing to the dangers of claiming the NCR alone espoused a moral position and of holding to the Bible as the answer book freed from ambiguities and enigmas. Mainliners objected also to the NCR linking God's will to America's future. Sojourners magazine wrote a stinging piece on there that God's will and America's future were one and the same, or discernible. All right. Other critics feared the implications of attempting to make America, quote, Christian at the expense of the nation's dedication to pluralism and voluntarism. Perhaps the most powerful objection to the NCR was its explicit trust in the ability of the national government to be the major instrument of moral reform. That was my thesis, you remember, at the beginning. The NCR's contradictions became evident. It proposed to remove the government from the private sector, yet advocated government regulations in abortion, in sexual lifestyles, and in prayers, which are, you know, very personal matters. Implicitly, the NCR called for a punitive state, whereby the body politic determines private mores and punishes deviations from them. To establish the government as the enforcement agency for a sectarian code of morals remains a grave threat to the American freedoms, which the NCR claims to support. With this, okay. Act 3. Lack of electioneering clout coupled with the evangelical and mainline criticism is no indication that the NCI will simply die on the vine. And this is the update. Several programs which the moral majority is now pursuing may well produce a backlash or a new groundswell of support. Falwell kept himself on the front pages following the election in a name-calling spat with the editor of Penthouse magazine. The point with Penthouse was it was just like Jimmy Carter with Lust, you remember, in 1976. They didn't know how to cope with suddenly being a national celebrity. They didn't know what to do when they got themselves in a PR jam, and they came up with some really stupid, responses with this. Claiming that he did not know that the magazine would print an interview he gave to two independent reporters, Falwell attempted to block the distribution of the issue carrying the interview. I mean, he actually called on the courts to issue an injunction, which is directly contrary to the First Amendment. Okay. A federal judge dismissed his petition on grounds of freedom of expression. Right. Another PR thing. Falwell attempted to block the distribution of copies of Thomas Jefferson's Virginia statutes on religious freedom. Well, when you try to censor Thomas Jefferson in the United States, I suggest maybe you've got to do a little historical research with this. Okay, his effort was defeated. There's an understatement. All right, and here's one which many of you will remember. The Washington State chapter of Moral Majority demanded that the state library identify those to whom a movie entitled "Achieving Sexual Maturity" was distributed. Just how the film viewers would be guaranteed freedom from harassment was not clarified. In Maryland, this is funny, in Maryland, the moral majority objected to the sale of gingerbread cookies that were sexually explicit. Bakery sales increased dramatically. It's just like banning a movie in Boston. That's the best thing. Movie producers hope and pray that the movie will be banned. Remember the old Legion for Decency sort of thing? It has reached the oblivion it so richly deserves. With us. In California, a leading moral majority spokesperson demanded capital punishment for homosexuals. This made Dan Rather's news. And then later he had a reconsideration with it, but he came out for it. In Indiana, the moral majority leaders made a complaint to the Child Welfare Office when it learned the office of the Child Welfare Office placed a child battered by his father under the custody of the maternal grandparents. Moral Majority's representatives argued that such vigorous discipline was biblically sound. And one can argue such incidents are exceptions. They receive extensive media attention and could create an image in the minds of that 60% of the voters who are unfamiliar with the Moral Majority. We do not know what that image might be. It could generate either a groundswell of criticism or renewed mass support for the Moral Majority and its moral codes. It's much like groups in the 1960s when we had such old new Christian right stalwarts as Carol McIntyre and Billy James Hargis. A lot of people were turned off when some supporters and endorsers started giving them money, but there was one gasoline company or petroleum company that gave McIntyre a lot of money. And so what happened was people, especially in California, drove up to the station and said, "Give me some of that anti-communist gasoline." It works both ways. You lose some support one way and you gain some somewhere else with us. Okay. Evidence suggests the NCR is not continuing in the steady growth of previous years. In February of 1981, for instance, Christian Voice circulated a desperate plea for immediate additional funds from its members, claiming it would go out of business without instant support. Mainline denominations announced large new planning for their own television programs aimed at the large national audiences reached by the electronic preachers. Such clues, however, do not provide conclusive evidence that the NCR has reached its highest plateau of strength. Historically, the Christian right in America flourished when it was led by such stalwarts as Billy Sunday or Carl McIntyre. Their influence remained limited, however, because they were unable to reach mass audiences. That's very important. This is not the case today. Electronic preachers and direct mailers have mastered technological weapons the older Christian right never dreamed possible. That's the basic difference between, let's say, a Billy Sunday around World War I or a Carl McIntyre in the 50s and 60s. That they used the radio and used it very well, but they simply didn't have the technology that the new Christian right has today. Television, for instance, can be used to shape conscious thinking and influence behavior to an extent far greater than that is now fully understood. Having mastered quickly these television techniques, electronic evangelists have tapped only a fraction of the power inherent in televised broadcasting. In summary, this is the the finale here. In summary, the hard evidence now suggests the NCR is not increasing its 1980 gains. It is pursuing an isolationist course, and its excesses have created a greater public awareness of Christian right activities. Yet, if the NCR can retool its programs and avoid previous post-election mistakes, it may move through television and the mails to the center of American political and religious life. It's altogether possible, for instance, that we'll have denominations from the 700 Club and the PL and the PTL, right in your very hometown, accountable to nobody, obviously, but to themselves. That they may move to the center of American religious and political life. Those who seek to share the gospel differently than the NCR have shown signs of willingness to recapture the initiative. They might find in their attempts a fresh source of vitality and purpose for this new decade. The floor is open. Yep.
I have read and repeated a number of times that Falwell saying that his movement is not a religious movement, but a moral one, thereby trying to enlist the support of Jews, Muslims, and Mormons. He said that explicitly. How successful has he been?
It's too early to tell, unless you can get the mailing lists and the addresses of people. If you get a lot of people from Utah, you know that you've been successful out there. Or if you get people from the Upper West Side in New York. But I would say there aren't that, in the Jewish community, I would say, historically speaking, and with a very few exceptions, the Jewish community, because it's known oppression and second-class citizenship and all the rest, has been traditionally liberal for a long, long time, and I would be very surprised, especially after Bailey Smith's thing, that there would be any Jewish support for this. The Mormon community, generally speaking, is conservative anyway, and you've got Hatch and Garn, isn't he the other? Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and they're well entrenched, on the other hand, it has to be said that what Falwell and these others have done, and done brilliantly, and I mentioned this briefly before, was to take all these enormous number of one-issue groups. I've got them listed, many of them listed in the book, and you could name many others. Phyllis Schlafly's group, the National Rife Association, all of these, and get these people to stop quibbling and get behind one campaign. And so far, that momentum has lasted. And the only thing that might break that down is that some people will say, and it's already happened a couple times on a couple of Reagan's budget proposals, that Reagan isn't going far enough. Jeremiah Denton and a couple others said he wasn't going far enough. That might happen, but I don't think there's any conclusive evidence that Falwell's done that yet.
Larry, did you point to make on that?
Well, it's a point about Reagan.
Yeah.
Okay. So. I've got a new idea, so
why
don't you go ahead.
Well, I'd just like to hear your opinion on the possibilities with Reagan, because there's great hope in those quarters that Reagan will be their representative.
Yep.
And two things strike me as deflecting that. One is the office. He must be president of all the people.
Yep.
And so be responsive to pressures from more than one sector.
Right.
And secondly is the general disposition bearing character of the man, who, when you read his statements on paper, sound farther to the right than seeing him in person.
He
does not exemplify the politics of resentment. So all sorts of people like Reagan and don't like his policies.
Yeah,
it's an interesting sort of.
Yeah, it's a very interesting phenomenon. I already have seen, maybe some of you saw Rich Little's impersonation and he noticed that the first thing Reagan will say in answer to a tough question, he'll, they turn his head and that crinkly smile and say, "Well," and then when Little did this, he got a letter back from Reagan, and Reagan's opening statement was in capital letters, "Well," and then about 15 periods with an exclamation point with this, and he's mastered this technique brilliantly. And I admire him from an electioneering campaign to do that, to make the most conservative kind of statements and make them sound like it's shucks, down home, Saturday Evening Post, Reader's Digest kind of stuff with this. We're just moving a little bit away from this. And he did get in some trouble, obviously, for nominating George Bush with this. But these people, what's interesting this time, you see, with the fundamentalists, is that they are willing this time to give Reagan the benefit of the doubt, because they keep thinking that he's more on their side than the other, and that he has to make a few concessions to the center, but that on the really important things he isn't. And this is one reason right now that Reagan isn't yielding, as he said, this would be, what, Saturday, he said Thursday, he isn't yielding 1 inch on Lefebvre, for instance. And if you think Lefebvre is conservative, read the vita or the background on Dr. Koop. Who's to the right of Louis XIV, you know, in his politics, and has no experience in public health. He's the one who teamed up with Francis Schaeffer, for instance, in that film series that was circulated a couple of years ago, with us. Reagan is, you know, the whole thing is that he thinks he's got the momentum to carry through the 30% tax cut, and they're talking back and forth, and they're going through the jockeying position, you know, instead of the 25% with this. But I would say, you know, you can't give a percentage to this, that the new right is willing to give him the necessity to appoint a few people to use Bush, for instance, and so on. But the key people are the ones that the new right would associate with. For instance, in the issue I'm talking about here, with the connections with the religious world, Reagan's full-time director of religious activities or liaison to the religious world is Robert Billings. And Robert Billings, before he resigned that position, was the number two man in the moral majority. You know, you draw your own conclusions. Every president has a full-time liaison with the religious communities. I forget the name of the fellow from that Carter had. He was a Southern Baptist. And to show you the realities of how powerful people have become, when PTL had its fifth anniversary, there was the direct emissary of Jimmy Carter at the PTL celebration. They didn't, you know, they don't come out to the ALC celebrations, but they sure are out at the PTL one with us. But I think that Reagan really is hard right. I don't think there's any question in that. So far, he thinks he's got the momentum. He's got the advantage now of the martyr complex or the martyr advantage, you know, to continue this. Yeah.
You know what's scary to me is you kind of said something in passing that. He's saying, well, it's just, you know, Saturday Evening Post stuff. That's what scares me about him more than anything, is that I think in his heart of hearts, he honestly thinks that he's, by touting this, is somehow going to get us back to the good old days.
Well, that was the whole theme of the 1980 Republican National Convention. I think I mentioned earlier in the week, if you listen to it very carefully, the whole thing was a refutation of Carter's 1979 summer Sunday night sermon. Remember, Carter had gone up to Camp David and suddenly realized the country was in a real mess. And he had been reading Lash's Culture of Narcissism and reading people like Heilbrunner and the rest of these, and beginning to see that we were in real trouble, and said we had to come back and lower our expectations, materially and every other way. Yes. And made this, I think, rather strong, almost mea culpa kind of statement. America isn't going to be the great leader, and the Republicans were waiting, and I watched gavel to gavel from Joe Lewis Arena in Detroit, and every speech got that in, that we can be this. Gerald Ford said that America can solve any problem if it puts a mind to it. And that's, you know, that's I don't question their sincerity. The only person, persons I really question the sincerity of are some of the technicians like Terry Dolan, who is a total pragmatist. He's the one who runs NPIC, or the National Coalition of Political Action Committees. Dolan is and says it straight out, with no apologies whatsoever, that we will do whatever works. The reason they picked out these six senators was they thought they would win. They didn't pick out Gary Hart because they thought he would win anyway, no matter how much money they pumped into Colorado or Packwood or any of the others. And if they see they're losing in a state, they'll pull out. If they see that one issue will work in a state more than another, like Baby Killer against McGovern, they will use it. If they don't think it will work, they'll pull it out. He's a total pragmatist. What they simply like is using and manipulating political techniques, you know, for their own sake, and they're brilliant at it. If you look at it from a totally sort of impersonal and strategic standpoint, they are so far ahead of the liberals and the moderates that it's staggering. They simply mastered how to get money and how to get votes, and do it, you know, brilliantly. That's the only, you know, I stand in admiration of how they've been able to do this. Yeah.
In talking about all the issues in the 1980s, you know, the gay rights, everything else, there was no mention of the Iran hostage crisis. And I think that was probably one of the hottest things that got Reagan, and, you know, that allowed this new right to emerge, you know, saying that, gee, Carter and the liberals and all that stuff, they can't get our people out of Iran.
Okay.
You know, we're not moral enough, we're not strong enough, our defensive posture is too great. We lost our power.
But what they've learned is that in politics, you can you have to remember, or you can't expect the American public or the American voters to remember too many issues. So they concentrated on five or six issues and hit those very, very hard, because it's like television appealing to about the 12-year-old mentality. If you listed too many issues, the American voter would become confused. But if you could zero in on, and it happened to be five issues, and drove those home over time and time again, or repeating over and over and over again, they would remember this. And every so often, if you wanted to get a standing ovation or something, you could talk about the fact that if we were really tough, if we really knew what we were doing, that rescue team would have gotten them out of Tehran and everything else. Just another sign of American,
I wonder if there was a groundswell of
support
for these conservatives, because a lot of people felt impotent, and they couldn't do anything about the situation, and even though they might not have necessarily agreed with the five issues, they agreed with the whole, overview of power.
Yeah. What didn't come out with the Iranian thing was the fact that, who was it, Stansfield Turner said afterwards, after he's out of office, that if we had gone ahead and if the helicopters had gotten into Tehran, at least 15% of the hostages themselves would have been killed. How would that have happened? How would that have gone across in this country? And it also depended, the Tehran rescue thing, also depended on the fact that we have been guaranteed that there would be enough Iranians loyal to the American cause to join in with the commandos as they landed on the embassy at the time. We had inside information, in other words, that there were people loyal to the Shah who would do this. Now, what if that support hadn't materialized? And we had sent in our eight helicopters full of the commandos with, who was it, Major, what was his name? The Green Beret? Whatever. Who?
I just call him Major Ed.
Oh, okay. Anyway, Edsel, yeah, that's a good pseudonym. Anyway, what if that material, hadn't, but that didn't come out with us. But I think you're right that it was another signal that America no longer could call the shots around the world.
Yeah, and that's coincided, Kurtzman's point, coinciding with the Jimmy Carter speech.
Right. And they didn't send enough helicopters, and they should have assumed that more than two would break down, and all
the helicopters are breaking down.
And then they crashed into each other,
The reason I was interested in that book, I just spotted it up there and I saw this class, is that I wanted to find out what this moralism business was all about.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, because I just have never been able, ever since it started, even as much as I respected the man for what he was saying, from what Billy Graham and company, for the way they were presenting the gospel and the follow-up of people who committed their lives to Christ, the lack of a one-on-one basis, and this whole thing, I would just like to ask, what would Jesus do, what would be his reaction were he to walk in on the big four in their splendid stuff, and the guy's telling you that, look, God wants you to have a pink Cadillac. I got a pink Cadillac. He wants you to be happy. The theology of glory rather than the theology of the cross. They're using the gospel for political reasons or to get a point across. And the demagogues they want to get rid of are replaced by the religious demagogues who are going to tell me how to worship. And as far as it's getting my opinion and giving me any of these folders to sign or whatever, I never even heard of until I read in your book about all this door-to-door stuff. I guess, Wenatchee is not a hopeless place.
Wenatchee's pretty conservative. I mean, you've got Earl Tilly down there. And
they didn't have to send us anything yet.
I couldn't, obviously it's a rhetorical question, and I read a phrase Wednesday or whenever it is, all the days up here get to be alike, from Virginia Stem Owens' book, talking about the fact that a total outsider who knew nothing about Christianity came back and looked at those who are professing Christ today, would they be able to think that this wonderful phrase used, that this vagrant celibate which is, you know, the sacred celebrate, who celebrated the mournful meek rather than the smiling success, was the person we worshipped and followed. I mean, when I look at the mahogany line panels, and I look for one wonderful one with Pat Robertson, there was an interview in Harper's, and a man from Harper's went down, admittedly hostile from the very beginning, no question. And Robertson's predicting that the world is going to end in 1982. We could get into the whole premillennial thing if you wanted to here, which is important. And if the world is, he also noted at the same time that in Robertson's headquarters down in Virginia Beach, Virginia, they are planting trees, and which will take 50 years to mature. Well, if the world's going to end in 2 years, why the heck, plant trees that are going to take 50 years to mature? With this as a small, as a small instance from this. But no, I agree with the guy. It's triumphalism, very much. Yeah.
Jerry follows that Jesus would love nuclear war, a nuclear.
Well, I don't want to see the quotation on that. I don't want to get too carried away because I've got a quotation.
I saw him on television. Basically, the statement was that Jesus was a man's man.
Oh yeah, that goes way back. I mean, that's old. That's I'm not saying it's good, but that's old stuff in American. Well, Theodore Roosevelt was the first proponent of that with muscular.
Jesus looks more over us.
No, I don't know about that. But, no. Jesus, muscular Christianity, that goes way back to T.R. Theodore Roosevelt. And he was a rugged he-man, and he was a carpenter, and so he had strong muscles. And that's not new, but it's always, it's always a winner. Bruce Barton, Jesus, the greatest salesman of all time. Yeah.
I think the scary thing is that they didn't ask you, that they didn't contact you, that they're so well organized.
Oh yeah, they know where
to trade all of their money where it's gonna get results, and they're not gonna put their bizarre teachings out where people are really gonna examine them. So they can say really bizarre things, keep them within their circle, and not spend any money distributing them outside.
You see, that's where they're so well organized. They know how to read politics. They know that Iowa was vulnerable, but they didn't touch Minnesota. If you remember in the watching on election day, if you have color TV, you remember that big vast sea of blue on the map of the United States and that one red state right in the middle. And the moral majority isn't organized in Minnesota. We've got Richard Angwin of the Temple Baptist Church in St. Paul as the closest example of it, but they're not organized. We've got two moderate to conservative senators in Boschwitz and Durenberger, but that's just because of they don't have Humphrey around any longer to crack the whip on the DFL, but they're organized some places very well, but not others. And they know exactly what they're doing. They know political behavior, political motivation. They can push the buttons and they can get results. Vickery can get out 20 million pieces of mail in 3 days on something like gun control, and he can have and junk mail. They've got to prove that if you get 1% return on your mail, that's more than paid for itself. In junk mail, in anything. That's not just in politics, but that's anything else. Yeah.
So you said there were five main issues that they concentrated on.
Yeah.
What were they again?
Well, that was the prayer and next Bible reading in public schools, abortion, ERA, gay rights, and then the increase the military.
That's the one I was interested
okay.
in.
The other four are quote family issues.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the whole business of the American family is in decline, and all brothers and sisters say amen, And the other one has to do with their eschatology or with their doctrine of the last things. These are premillennial eschatology people, and they follow us and got up in his pamphlet, the Bible, the future, and you, that the world is going to end around the year 2020 or 2007. Yeah, he disagreed with Robertson on this. And Robertson has stayed out pretty much. Okay, except in a general sense. And therefore, since the world is going to end very soon, what we and since Russia is the Antichrist, or the communism is the Antichrist, it is absolutely necessary to stop the Antichrist now and use the time we have left to convert as many people as possible before Armageddon comes. That's the reasoning for it, and he says it straight out in that pamphlet. And you can write to him at in Lynchburg and get the pamphlet, The Bible, the Future, and You.
It's back to McIntyre's idea that the peace symbol is really the symbol of the Antichrist.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I forgot. You just spoiled my day by reminding me of that.
it's the cross inverted for us.
Yeah, actually, Lender Bundy of the Church League of America, and he was the sort of the think tank for McIntyre. Yeah.
I have a question. You keep talking about the religious right being organized. Mm-hmm. And I think they've got a big advantage over us liberals that they can be dogmatic. They are not the least bit embarrassed to say vote against this guy because he believes in gun control. And they consider that an adequate reason, and they consider that something that should be done. How can we battle against that? I have so much trouble when I run into a rabid conservative, and they have all these pat answers, and I just have this sort of commitment to flexibility, you know.
Anybody want to take a shot at that?
Yes.
Jim?
I think that one reason that groups in the 20th century, I'm not calling people fascist or Nazi at all. Emily,
that sounds like Richard Nixon.
I'm really not. Emily grew up in Vienna, and we've talked for years about why the socialists and the left and the liberals and anarchists have a problem. Is they're fighting against father. And the Nazis, with all their revolutionary, shocking amoralities, appeared to be for father. Hitler in public was for the old Hindenburg. In private, he says he's a senile bull.
Yeah.
And Hitler in public wanted to wipe out German national differences. Hitler in private wanted to wipe out German national differences. In public, he wanted to emphasize them. And so the people that have done the dreadful damage in the conservative cause have been for father, for flag, and for the family. And these are eternal verities in our land. Well, that's about all. The liberals and others appear to have some doubts about father. Where's the flag, military, and so forth. And it's very difficult to have a successful campaign. One other small point, too, if you don't mind. Hannah Arendt, in her great book, The Origin of Totalitarianism, said when the Nazis came in, they destroyed labor unions, they destroyed powerful churches which opposed them, whether Jewish or evangelical Christian or fascist or and the Nazis allowed people to worship, Catholic and Protestant and so forth, as long as those churches were rather quiet. Larry knows so much about this. Her point about the totalitarian thing in Russia and Germany is that each individual had a relationship to the state, and that the tough local things were destroyed. Now the electronic church has an individual person who's close ties to a mean, tough, pacifist Quaker group that's very weak. but their relationship to the old verities as they watch on their home and listen on the radio is a slight analogy, please, I'm not trying to be a demagogue, a slight analogy to Russia under Stalin and Germany under Hitler. A lonely person listening, and that person is usually not in a tough, mean labor union, a tough, mean militant church. They are a lonely but good American wanting to be obedient to a wonderful father. Well, I don't know what liberals can do about it.
any other non-answers here?
I wanted to ask a different question.
Different question? Anybody want to
follow up on
Jim?
Related sure. to that is yeah. that I heard of some liberals back east somewhere getting tough. They have huge full-page newspaper ads saying,
yeah.
I don't know if it was Jerry Falwell, but it was Jerry Falwell or whoever lies. And
yeah.
then gave specific examples
yeah.
of, who was it?
ProPAC,
yeah.
Yeah.
They are, but they're arguing among themselves, too. There should be one centralized organization. But
yeah.
but I've got a tape if anybody wants. It's a wonderful sort of paradox. B'nai B'rith, which is an educational arm of the American Jewish community, is sending Bob Brown or Robert McAfee Brown, one of the interesting and important theologians around the country, on speaking campaigns about the need, with the title, The Need for the Moral Minority. And I've got the tape if anybody wants it. And so there are some beginnings, but boy, they've got a long ways to go. That's and because what these people have done is come under NPIC and have one agency and with Vickery to you know to do it all. And there's American Civil Liberties Union, and you've got ADA, and then you've got AFL-CIO, and all these different ones. And until they centralize, they're going to diffuse their energies. And on the question
about centralizing sort of goes against the liberal brain.
Yeah, in that sense it does. I think one, there has to be a centralized planning agency with this, and secondly, just keep hammering away at the issues and expose the idea that what they are really talking about is a return to a Christian theocracy. Where only people of one, you know, in a one kind of moral theological persuasion would prevail. And I think that's, once that gets through, there's some, you know, there's, that's all you can really do after that point. But if, for instance, inflation goes down and unemployment goes down, in 1982 there are 20 people on the hit list and there may be, you know, 20 new faces, you know, on the hill. I'm reasonably negative about the success for this. Because I think some people like even Hayakawa's on the hit list, but that's because he's pro-choice, and that's the only reason he's pro-choice. And Marilyn Sarbanes, that's the one that scares me because he's such a gifted senator. And the one thing, you know, politics is politics, and the one thing that bothers me personally is that the people who replaced Culver and the others are such mediocrities. Mm-hmm. Only in Wisconsin was there a good person, Bob Kirsten, who replaced Gaylord Nelson, who I think is a good, you know, a good lawmaker. But this and the other ones, they're all enormous mediocrities.
Pick up on that.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
Your thesis, did you say that the moral majority in the new right really didn't play a significant role in the loss of?
With a couple of exceptions, like Jeremiah Denton, who had been a POW member in Vietnam, and in Idaho with Frank Church, and maybe one or two others, Iowa maybe, Culver, and what's the names?
Grassley.
Yeah.
I'd like to just, as an example, maybe
yeah.
an extreme one, but within about 10 days before the election, I taught an interdisciplinary course with a couple others on peace and justice. We invited Grassley one day and Culver to come mm-hmm. and came. And what you say about the two is, Grassley is a good-intended person, but on a scale of competence,
yeah,
you know, it's just night and day.
Yeah,
Culver was moving up.
Yeah,
they were fighting
of course,
majority.
Yeah,
the last 2-3 days they had a blitz campaign in
yeah.
Iowa that made the polls. Culver had just gone ahead.
Yeah,
and he ended up losing by 6-8 points.
Yeah,
and I couldn't believe that had happened. About the next weekend, I met with some other colleagues from Lutheran schools. One was from Augustana. He said the same thing happened to McGovern
yeah.
and in
yeah.
Cranston. There was a blitz in the last 2-3 days
mm-hmm.
that brought out the conservative element of Iowa. And I think they had a major role in bringing down the...
Yeah, well, you know, the final analysis remains to be seen, but there's no question that they poured, what was it, over $400,000 into Iowa, as I remember it. With this, I think McGovern would have lost anyway, because he simply had ignored his fence mending in
We might have been
accepted.
And so on.
In Iowa, though, the competency level was really phenomenal.
Yeah.
As in Grassley, you know, he came off the, looks like he came off the Grant Wood pictures.
Yeah.
He was
Iowa had already shown where it was going by turning out Clark in 78, and the moral majority hadn't organized him, but there were a couple of other embryonic new right groups that were organized and turned him out, and then McIntyre in New Hampshire too, and they got excited about that because they had won in 78 and they thought they had a formula, so that gave them the encouragement to continue their efforts. See, what they did was to take a voting bloc which had never been active before, and Falwell is the first himself to admit that he reversed a major commitment of himself. Because it always used to be that fundamentalists and some evangelicals would say politics is dirty, politics deals with corruption, politics deals with compromise, and you can't compromise with the truth, and all these things, and you stay out. You have one-to-one evangelism, and what you do is get people to be born again. And now, suddenly, there's a total reversal. And that was my thesis, that they're using the power of the national government to do this, and you organize voters, and they had as many as, we think, 72,000 ministers out telling people to vote conservative. What was it? Falwell said, you have to do three things: baptize them, save them, and register them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they are putting the churches directly into the elective process. And one thing I argue in the book is that if the mainline churches don't want to provide opportunities for other political voices to be heard, then the mainline churches get what they deserve. I'm not saying that the political, obviously because of tax laws and all the rest of these things, that mainline churches should get into elective politics at all. But what I am arguing is that churches where there is pressure from the New Christian Right should offer opportunities for all of the records and all of the explanation, all of the nuances on various voting records to be heard, so that you just don't have a list of 10 and 10 issues and say this is it. If churches don't, then they're weak put, from their inactivity. And this is very difficult. And the other thing is that I think is necessary is to remember that only 53.2% of the total American public voted in the 1980 election. 53.2%, which tells us something about the confidence American people have in the institutions of the government. And this is why I think this business about Reagan getting a landslide, sure he won, but a landslide is silly. A landslide is 54 or 55%. But 51% is not a landslide. And if you put Anderson and Carter together, you've got 49% with this. So Reagan got 51%, which is not a landslide. But Reagan got 27.5% of the total American adult population. Well, if real effort can be gotten to turn out the votes, provide buses, do the whole thing, that's one way in which the mainline and the moderates, and the liberals have to go, and they didn't do it, they really didn't do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, up here, sure.
I first want to make a remark towards the McGovern thing. I mean, I was during election time in South Dakota because I went to school there. And the hope for McGovern, anyway, I would support you wearing all the things because, I mean, it looked like he would maybe win, but the last week before the election was sure he would lose because he just didn't have enough support in the western part of South Dakota.
Yeah.
And the other thing is I want to ask, do you see any chances for the moral majority to push through their ideas about ERA and the abortion law?
Well, they've won right now on ERA. Right now, they've won on ERA. If they haven't, they've got 35 states, and a couple, you can't rescind. The Supreme Court has ruled that you can't rescind once you've adopted a constitutional amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So in spite of the fact that some states like Kentucky have rescinded, you can't rescind. But they've got 35 and they aren't going to get the other ones. How many times has it come up in Illinois? 7 times?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. And it's lost every time in Illinois. And the other states that haven't approved are such flaming radicals as Alabama, Mississippi, and Nevada, places like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they've already won on ERA.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have to do anything anymore with ERA. What was the other one?
The other one was the abortion laws. Do you think their influence is pretty obvious in the proposed laws?
You want to try that one, Larry?
Well, I haven't watched it terribly closely in the last couple of weeks. There were major hearings about 3 weeks ago under Senator East.
Yeah. Sister Teresa testified yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. And she said that abortion was killing in the image of God.
Yeah.
So I don't know where it stands. There's no question that there's a great deal of support.
Yeah.
If not for the constitutional amendment by Dornan, but for the Hyde-Helms bill, they don't vary in content essentially, but the constitutional amendment requires 3/4 ratification. Of the state, so that won't go. But the other one is getting a lot of support.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't know what the prognosis is at present.
It's
on passing the bill in its essence, which is that human life is deemed to exist from the moment of conception.
It's very iffy, and a couple of variables could throw it either way. Yeah, really, because the pro-life, I mean, the pro-choice people are really very well organized, too.
Yeah.
Very well organized,
But one thing that's happening there, however, is that the legal community is seeing nightmares here.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a growing opposition to the bill apart from the stand on abortion. How do you enforce a law
that has the ramifications of that one in terms of enforcing it.
Yeah.
And what are the consequences if it is unenforceable?
Right.
So I know, for example, a lot of lawyers in Congress, and there are, that's most of Congress, a lot of lawyers in Congress are having real doubts about it, even when they themselves oppose abortion.
Yeah.
There's always a danger when you're in a group of people who essentially agree on many issues to see the opposition as very different than us. We've been painting these people as single issue people and seeing only a few issues. I don't think the liberals are that much different. In terms of back in 68 and 72, we were very much seeing people as either pro or anti-war, pro civil rights or anti-civil rights. And the only difference is the right has done it now. The right was fragmented before, and now they're not. The left was disciplined before, and now they're not. And as far as the their stand on single issues, I think that's an American shortcoming. We just tend to polarize everything.
Who wants to take a swing at that one? My editor asked me that after he read my manuscript, that same question.
I'll take a stab at that.
Okay.
The family issue is one that, I don't know, I guess I'm trying to deal with, that supposedly anti-abortion, anti-gay, anti-ERA, and so on, are all pro-family. Rosemary Ruther in Christianity in Crisis did a wonderful brief article saying what the real family issues were, you know, that the idea is to create family that's nurturing and upbuilding, okay? And that the left and the right may have different views on what that means, but that the left was just as pro-family as the right is. And I think the key is that the single issue stuff on the right, in a lot of cases, is kind of single issue, whereas on the left, it is more of a big package thing. I mean, I can say I'm really anti-war, but it's because I'm pro-life in a lot of other ways, you know. And I think the idea is to somehow create a package of what pro-life is. And that can mean anti-war, anti-abortion, you know, that kind of thing. I don't feel single issue at all, even though I feel very strongly on some issues. And I think I honestly believe that liberals tend to be more pro-life in a general sense, not the politics of resentment. I think there's more of the politics of resentment on the right than there is on the left. I hope.
I think they see themselves just as packaged, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we can pick them apart, and I'm sure that the group of them sitting around their fireplace could pick us apart and find inconsistencies in our package. I think it's in the process.
Yeah. The way in which you resolve your conflicts is where the difference is. They would say that only those who believe in the inerrant, infallible, verbally inspired Bible have the answers, and that therefore everybody, agnostics, atheists, everybody else, have to measure up to those, you know, even if it's against their will. And if you don't, we'll pass a constitutional amendment to take care of you. And on the anti-war. And the other things, moderates to liberals say we'll work within the system we have. We aren't going to work out final or perfect solutions, but we'll work within the framework of the policy making decision apparatus that we have now, where everybody can have an input. You see, that's what's frightening about the right, is that they will simply cut off opposition.
I think when the liberals were rabid in the late 60s, they were just as rabid.
I mean, you can be, you know, Marty says you can take any movement and criticize it because of its extremists.
The Congress in those days made a major shift in the war powers, which may have been just, you know, and whether we agree with that or not, it was the same type of shift. They're talking about.
But you see, Daniel Berrigan wasn't in Congress, and is an example of the extremists who represented a certain position and who would do things like the Catonsville thing and the rest and chain himself to the White House gates and so on with this. And that isn't necessarily, as much as I admired him, which I do very much, that isn't necessarily the main thrust of how the liberals went around it. They worked through the processes and didn't try to say that there can't be opposition any longer, or work out constitutional, when all else fails, work out a constitutional amendment that says we're not going to let you try to oppose or change or anything else. The old Jeffersonian idea of the marketplace of ideas still has to prevail with all its imperfections.
The abortion, the Hyde-Helms bill is a perfect example. It is not simply a bill on abortion. It says that the laws regulating abortion shall be absolved from the Supreme Court's interpretation of the 14th Amendment.
And that goes back directly to contrary to what they decided for us in Philadelphia in 1787. Right.
Yeah.
If that's what they're doing with the Constitution, and if they say that they're pro-Constitution, you see, that's the difference. It's in the process. Oh, yeah, nothing to me is... You know, I agree, dogmatic liberals, good heavens. pain in the posterior, really.
Prohibition was the Constitution, too.
Yes, right. Yeah, and that was led by the liberals. This is what the interesting thing was, the prohibition. I don't, this is a historical thing, but prohibition was the idea being that alcoholism was such a serious social problem, and during the quote progressive period, 1900 to 1914 and so on, that they thought in the old Federal Council of Churches, the forerunner of the NCC, which nobody's going to call conservative, led the fight for this. And the conservatives, especially the Germans, German people were the ones who led the opposition for it. And I have to, some of you know, I tell stories about my hometown, and the most, quote, distinguished resident of my hometown was Andrew Volstead, who wrote the Volstead Act, obviously, and which became the basis for prohibition. And I always get mixed reactions from my St. Olaf students when I tell them that Andrew Volstead is a St. Olaf graduate who received a Distinguished Alumni Award because we're having a battle over alcohol policy at St. Olaf. And when we give Andrew Volstead a Distinguished Alumni Award, the students get a message there. So. But no, that's true. I didn't want to get off. That's just a little comic relief.
All these different groups that are promoting this and that and the other thing, it all seems like everybody is saying this little doctrine, everybody's out of step with God.
Oh yeah, this is what we call the balkanization. We talked about that earlier this week, the balkanization of America. And you're dividing up everybody, senior citizens with gray power, is real, Sun Belt versus Frost Belt, gays versus straight. The country is not going there, it's polarized. Very, 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 very strongly. And it isn't getting any better. No question. It's about that time. I'm glad to stay here for as long as I want. You work on something for a long time and you sit there quietly and you're wondering, is anybody out there listening? And you've had this experience, haven't you, Larry? You sit there and it's a very lonely thing. And suddenly, gosh, somebody's listening to what I'm saying. And I was hoping I'd get some more opposition today. We're going to have to call in Earl Tilley and some of the others maybe I shouldn't put that on tape. Because he's a supporter.